from WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence. I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Less than 1 hour from now, President George W. Bush goes before the nation and the world to outline plans for a formal handover of sovereignty to Iraqis on June 30th, just 5 weeks from now. The televised speech delivered at the Army War College in Carlisle Barracks, Pennsylvania, comes at a crucial time. A new CBS poll finds the president's approval rating dropping to an all-time low of 41%. 61% of Americans now disapprove of Bush's handling of Iraq, which remains racked by violence, instability, and growing Iraqi disillusionment with American oversight. The White House has turned to the United Nations to design and sanction an Iraqi caretaker government. At this moment, that UN plan is still being negotiated in Iraq and in New York. And President Bush's political fate appears to hinge on the so far troubled outcome of a war of his own making. Tonight on Point, the president sells his plans for Iraq to the American people and the world. We begin in Baghdad, where this morning an explosion killed two British civilians and mortar rounds were fired by insurgents into Baghdad neighborhoods. Fierce fighting has been reported in Najaf between U.S. troops and forces loyal to Shiite cleric Muqtada al-Sadr. Vivian Walt is a correspondent for Time magazine in Baghdad. I asked her to describe how Iraqis are looking at the scheduled June 30th handover.
Very confused, actually, and I think even among, you know, analysts and people who are supposed to know what's going on, there seems to be an incredible lack of clarity as to what exactly the plan is. So far, we've really seen nothing. Lakhdar Brahimi, the UN special envoy to Iraq, has been here for 3 weeks, locked in meetings, and we've heard almost no specifics, really, about what exactly this new government is going to look like. So I think for Iraqis, it's really still quite abstract.
Remind us, if you would, what Lakhdar Brahimi is supposed to produce in terms of a structure.
It's still, believe it or not, a little bit unclear. I've spoken to Brahimi's staff who are here, and basically it seems to be shaping up vaguely to be a prime minister who will be the real nuts and bolts head of the government. And then there will be three more or less ceremonial figures, one president and two deputy presidents. This is somewhat necessary because you've got three major ethnic groups in the country, each of whom is going to want a very important title. Beyond that, we have almost no idea yet who is going to be heading this government, or indeed how big it's going to be, and how many of the current governing council members are going to be included in it.
Brahimi's deputy is saying today that he's running about a week behind schedule, that is, for some early glimpse of his plans on May 31st, a month before the handover. Why is this all taking so long, Vivian Walt? Is it they've had difficulty figuring out who to name, or they're afraid to name the officials for fear that they might be assassination targets?
I think it's actually a bit of both. And, you know, Tom, it's been just a week since they assassinated the president of the governing council. Being a politician in Iraq is no easy task at the moment. You are automatically subject to having a price on your head. And I think that people are somewhat hesitant to be named too early. On the other hand, they really have to put this together pretty quickly because there's some urgent decisions to work out that cannot really wait until the end of June. Perhaps the most urgent being what exactly the American forces status is going to be after June 30th. There's still no agreement about the 130,000 or so American soldiers in Iraq and what their rules of engagement are going to be.
Though we're told the United States is insisting that it will still command its own force there, obviously.
Yes, realistically, the U.S. is really not going to give that up without quite a fight. But this goes to really quite a raw issue among many Iraqis, and I was asked today at the university talking to some students about what they think of this, and everybody, almost to a person, said, you know, we just feel like the whole country is going to be run out of the American embassy. And indeed, they are building the biggest American embassy in the world here in Baghdad. So Iraqis are really quite cynical about this whole process.
Is there any signal so far whether this leading official, the prime minister after June 30th of Iraq, will be Shiite or Sunni or Kurd?
Well, there are two different hints. The one that name, of course, that keeps coming up time and again is Adnan Pachatbi, who's a very, very seasoned diplomat. He is Sunni, speaks perfect English. He's also very close to Brahimi, has known him for decades, in fact, from his time as a diplomat in Geneva. But there are a couple of other important Shia figures who are coming, who are emerging as possible candidates who are moderate Shia, and might in fact make a lot more sense at this point in time as figures who could possibly help persuade Sadr to disarm Muqtada al-Sadr, which has really become perhaps the most difficult problem in this country.
Vivian, do Iraqis believe that on June 30th, sovereignty will be put back in the hands of Iraqis?
The short answer, Tom, is no. When you ask Iraqis what sovereignty means, they kind of draw a blank. They don't know who they want for president. There's no real charismatic leader. There's no Karzai. There's no Mandela. There's no man in this country who can sweep the country along on the next wave into the future. And without that, they really are quite confused. And on top of that, as I said before, there is really is a sense that the Americans are going to have their fingers in a lot of pies in this country, and that essentially a lot of the real nitty-gritty decisions will have an American stamp of approval on it.
Are Iraqis worried that the country may be drifting toward chaos, toward civil war?
Well, Tom, I mean, the situation in the south really does look like it has the potential to do that. Already, you see a lot of tensions within the south, not just between Muqtada al-Sadr's militia and the Americans, but also between Sadr and more moderate Shia who are simply fed up with the whole fighting. The fighting has been going on for about 5 weeks now. Hundreds of people have been killed in the south. The mosques have been turned into weapons storage places, which sets off huge sensitivities among a lot of people. And I think for a long time, Sadr was on a wave of popularity, but it seemed to be backfiring a little bit. You see the early signs of that. So there are definitely a lot of potential problem areas where I'm not sure if civil war is really what you would call it, but certainly ongoing conflict looks like it could be a high probability whether this country is sovereign or not.
And finally, Vivian, what about President Bush's reputation, his leadership? How is it seen in Iraq today?
I would say it's pretty much rock bottom. I mean, I've been here since before the war, and I can't remember a time in which people have been so disparaging. It's not so much just that they're angry because the Americans haven't brought them security or electricity or jobs, whatever. The prison abuse scandal really introduced another element, and I think I can only describe it as a kind of disgust. You feel a kind of raw antipathy, which I didn't used to feel. It's going to take some time for Iraqis to get over this.
Vivian Walt, thanks very much for joining us tonight.
Sure thing.
Vivian Walt is an Iraq correspondent with Time magazine. She spoke with me from Baghdad. Back in Washington, President Bush is engaged in a tough battle for his own political survival. Democrats and members of his own party have grown deeply critical of his administration's handling of post-invasion Iraq. Support at home and abroad is dropping. In tonight's speech, the president will try to allay fears and rally support for the administration's mission in Iraq. Maura Reynolds is White House correspondent for the Los Angeles Times and is with the president at the Army War College. I asked her how challenging a task the president faces in trying to win support tonight.
It's unbelievably challenging. The president's Iraq policy has, at least in the public mind, seems to have run into the ground, and he's got to find a way to extricate it and convince the American public that it's moving forward apace.
How does he hope to do that tonight?
Well, the way this president has done it in the past is by insisting that everything is going well and that he knows exactly what he's doing, and saying it with such a degree of confidence that he hopes the American people share his confidence, that it's infectious. This will be a very, very difficult thing for him to do tonight because he has been saying many of the same things for many months, and the problem is that events on the ground are not backing him up. And so he's going to have to come up with a way of communicating with the American people that makes what they're seeing on the ground in Iraq make sense in some larger framework. And so far he has not succeeded in doing that.
Political leaders in Washington, Republicans and Democrats on Capitol Hill, have said it's not enough for the president to be reassuring tonight. The handover, whatever that entails, is only 5 weeks away. They and the American public need concrete details of what's going to happen on June 30th. Will he deliver that tonight?
Well, he's in a real bind as far as that's concerned, because the more details he provides, the more checkboxes the American public has to check off and say when things go right or wrong. The president is much more comfortable when he is speaking in generalities, because then he can speak about the goals and the general destination without hitting all of the spots that he expects to hit along the way. Mm-hmm. In other words, the more detail he gives, the more, in some ways, he sets himself up for failure as the weeks progress. So he's in a real difficult position.
But he's been criticized for having a kind of impromptu policy, seat of the pants, made up and made up again and made up again as he's gone along. Is that good enough now with only 5 weeks left?
Well, that remains to be seen. I mean, the bottom line is that the administration doesn't really have a policy on Iraq. What they have is a plan to turn over the political transformation to the United Nations. And so one reason that their policy seems so ill-formed is that, in effect, their policy is whatever Lakhdar Brahimi says. And he's the UN advisor who is trying to arrange an interim government that will lead to elections.
So, in other words, it's not the president's to announce, because he's not the guy who's deciding what the new Iraqi governmental structure will be?
Well, I think that would be going a little too far. But certainly right now, Brahimi has the upper hand in terms of the political transition. And the president needs to make sure that anything that he says is something that the UN is going to go along with. Either that, or he risks changing course, and that's something that this president really hates to do. He likes to have a very consistent message and stick to it.
Now, it's not only Lakhdar Brahimi, the special envoy in Iraq, but the entire UN Security Council at this point. The United States has just in the last day delivered a resolution that they hope the Security Council passes, which would be the kind of blanket authority for this handover on June 30th. What kind of noises are coming out of New York? The U.S. has had very tough relations with its Security Council partners. Is the U.N. Security Council ready to sign off on the American transition outline?
You know, I think that really remains to be seen. This administration has not handled relations with our U.N. allies particularly well in the past. On the other hand, they do all understand how important this resolution is. Without this resolution, there can't be a transfer of sovereignty. And the one thing that the Security Council wants more than anything else is to have an end to the occupation and give the Iraqis their sovereignty back. So in that sense, everyone's on board. The devil, of course, is always in the details. And the resolution that the U.S. and Great Britain tabled today doesn't say an awful lot about the details about how this interim sovereignty is going to work. So there's still an awful lot of discussion to be had with allies, and it really does remain to be seen how well the administration handles it and if they can convince them to get the things that they need to go forward.
And Maura, finally, the president's people are saying today that he'll deliver not only this speech tonight, but a series of speeches, maybe six speeches before June 30th around Iraq. That's an incredible focus of attention. How important is this issue for the president's reelection campaign right now?
Nothing is more important than that. The conventional wisdom for most of the last year has been that the most important issue for the president was jobs. And we've seen very strong job creation in the last several months, and the president's polls keep going down. What has happened is that the war has trumped the economy, at least at this point in time. And the president is very, very aware that this is more or less what happened to his father, that even though the economy was improving, that his father's polls were going down at this period of time before the election, and this spooks him and his advisors very much. That's why they're going to be pushing very hard on Iraq, try to make it seem like they have something more than the general goals that they've been outlining so far, that they have a specific plan and that they're making it work.
A lot depending on this speech tonight and those that will follow. Maura, thank you very much for joining us.
It's my pleasure.
Maura Reynolds is White House correspondent for the Los Angeles Times. She spoke with me from the Army War College in Carlisle, Pennsylvania, where President Bush will speak in just about 40 minutes. You can join our conversation tonight. What do you need to hear? What does the world need to hear from President Bush tonight? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Tonight, the president speaks on the future of Iraq, the first of six planned speeches aiming to bolster sharply lagging support for White House policy in Baghdad. We'll be looking at the challenges facing President Bush and Iraq tonight. You can join our conversation. Do you believe the White House, supported by the UN, is ready for some kind of effective handover in Iraq on June 30th? 61% of Americans now disapprove of President Bush's handling of Iraq. Are you in that number? Why? Or are you keeping the faith with President George W. Bush? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm joined tonight from Washington by Ambassador Peter Galbraith. He's Senior Diplomatic Fellow at the Center for Arms Control and Nonproliferation. He was U.S. Ambassador to Croatia. His article, How to Get Out of Iraq, appeared in the May 13th issue of the New York Book Review, or Review of Books, excuse me. Ambassador Galbraith, good evening and welcome back to On Point.
Tom, good to be with you.
It's great to have you and with us from Washington tonight. John Harwood, political editor at the Wall Street Journal. Good evening and welcome back, John Harwood.
Hi, Tom. Great to be here.
Wonderful to have you as always. John Harwood, first to you. We're going to look plenty tonight at what's going on in Baghdad. But back here in the United States, these numbers are not looking good for the president. Are you seeing, waves of fear coming out of the White House, or are they still emanating, we're in control, the country will come around? What's the mood?
When you talk, Tom, to people at the president's reelection campaign, they don't really disguise the concern that they feel over this situation. It's not exaggerating to say this has turned into a political crisis for the president. He had a job approval in a CBS News poll at 41% that was released today. A Washington Post ABC poll had it somewhat higher at 47.
41, the lowest of his presidency.
Yes, everybody who's polling now is finding the lowest number. They may have started from a different baseline.
Mm-hmm, right.
He's got taking increasing flack from his Republican base over the weekend. Richard Lugar, the Republican chairman of the Foreign Relations Committee, gave a speech that was implicitly critical of administration policy. He has got to do something to prevent the erosion in his public support. He hasn't lost the American people yet, but he's in danger of doing so. Has to explain tonight that the difficulties, which look quite severe at the moment, are a way station on the way to a better outcome that the American people can rally behind.
And Ambassador Peter Galbraith, as you look at the difficulties that everyone can see in Iraq as we speak tonight, do they look like a way station to a better future for Iraq that Americans can be proud of?
Absolutely not. The United States liberated Iraq, and the war was a great success, but the occupation has been a catastrophic failure, and it is a failure of the administration's making. It was the product of failing to prevent the looting, which was both predictable and preventable. Sending out to Iraq people recruited at the last minute without time to prepare. The Washington Post yesterday had a stunning story of how people recruited from a list of people who had sent their resume to the Heritage Foundation, recruited without a security check or finding out if they had any qualifications for the job.
That is throwing civilian bodies into the post-invasion rebuilding.
That is exactly right, and the Coalition Provisional Authority has been non-functional. The people in Iraq, called CPA, its initials, can't provide anything. And there's nothing in the current strategy to believe that more of it is going to produce success.
And yet something's going to happen here. We'll talk about what that might be. But before we go on, I want to play just a clip of retired General Anthony Zinni on 60 Minutes last night saying that heads must roll. In the Pentagon, a very sharp criticism from the man who was commander-in-chief of U.S. Central Command in charge of all troops in the Middle East, 97 to 2000. Here he is talking last night on 60 Minutes with correspondent Steve Croft.
I blame the civilian leadership in the Pentagon directly, because if they were given the responsibility, and if this was their war, and by everything I understand, they promoted it and pushed it, even to the point of creating their own intelligence to match their needs, then they should bear the responsibility. But regardless of whose responsibility I think it is, somebody has screwed up. And at this level and at this stage, it should be evident to everybody that they've screwed up. And whose heads are rolling on this? That's what bothers me most.
You think Secretary Rumsfeld, Deputy Secretary Wolfowitz, all those people should resign?
I believe that they should accept responsibility for that.
You're saying if you were them, you'd resign?
Yes, definitely.
Retired General Anthony Zinni, former Commander-in-Chief of U.S. Central Command. John Harwood, very tough criticism from a former very high-ranking U.S. military officer. What can the president say tonight that addresses this home front issue, or will he address the issue of whether or not this effort has been run with so many difficulties that heads should roll at home? Or is he going to be all looking at Baghdad and Iraq?
I don't think he's going to give any indication that he's going to fire Don Rumsfeld. He has, to the contrary, stood very closely behind Don Rumsfeld ever since his prisoner abuse scandal blew up. Really, at the end of the day, the guy who is going to be held accountable by the American people is George W. Bush himself. And if when we get to November, which will be 2 months in advance of when the president is promising that the Iraqi people will have free elections, if the American people think this war has been worth it, that it has advanced American security, that it's been good for Iraq and the Middle East, they'll reelect him. If they don't feel that way and they'll have ample evidence by that time to judge, they won't.
Peter Galbraith, there's the question at home in Iraq tonight. Given that so much of what unfolds there in the next month, 5 weeks, is in the hands of UN envoy Lakhdar Brahimi, what can the president say about what's going to happen? How specific can he be?
The trouble is he can't be specific at all. Here we are 5 weeks before the handover of power, and we are in the incredible position that we don't know who is going to take office in Iraq on the 1st of July. We don't know what powers that government is going to have. It's not yet decided what the role of the multinational force will be. In February, Ambassador Bremer, who's in charge of the U.S. operations there, spent much of the month working on an interim constitution for Iraq that included elaborate design for a U.S.-style Supreme Court. But he didn't turn to the issue of what was going to happen on the 1st of July. It's extraordinary.
That's still waiting to happen. John Harwood, what are you hearing in Washington about that? Is the White House waiting with white knuckles for Lakhdar Brahimi to announce what he's decided? They've got a special envoy of President Bush, Robert Blackwell, former U.S. ambassador to India, who's now in there with Brahimi. How much of a hand does the White House have on the steering wheel at this point in terms of this interim government that's being assembled?
I think the White House has a very big hand on the steering wheel, along with Lakhdar Brahimi. The question is, do they know where they're going? We've seen in the last week that we've been unable to protect the president of the governing council, who was assassinated a week ago. We've seen the Pentagon's former favorite, Ahmed Chalabi, have his house raided. Now all of a sudden we hear evidence that, well, maybe he was in cahoots with Iranian intelligence, and he's on the cover of Newsweek as America's con man in Iraq. This is a set of images that tell the American people the wheels are coming off this occupation. The president's challenge tonight is to try, in this form of a presidential address, although the networks are not going to be covering it live, it'll be on cable.
Very interesting. Do you think the president assumed they would carry him live when they put the speech at this time?
They didn't formally request the time. I think they expected that the networks would take it, but the networks ultimately decided not to. This is sweeps week, after all, and
right.
Fear factor has to be shown tonight.
Mm-hmm.
But the president has got to try to, for the American people, bring some order to this situation so that they can understand it and stay behind him. He tried to do it with his news conference a few weeks ago, but that didn't go so well. Now he's going to do it without the filter of the news media talking directly to the people.
So do you expect him to get into detail, or do you expect him to once again offer his kind of vision framework for what should be going on in Iraq, or will he get, you know, hard tacked on it?
I think it's going to be mostly familiar elements of detail. He'll talk about June 30th. He'll talk about the broad outlines of the new government. He'll talk about steps toward the election. He'll talk about continuing to work on rebuilding Iraqi infrastructure. But, you know, ultimately, events on the ground are going to determine whether or not this is a successful policy. You cannot talk your way out of a situation like this one.
Ambassador Galbraith, you have written, and many others have observed, that the U.S. strategy announced again and again is to hold Iraq together by establishing a strong central government. You write that ultimately little of this will come to pass. What do you mean?
Well, the fundamental problem of Iraq is that it is an artificial creation created by the British at the end of the First World War. It has always been held together by a Sunni Arab strongman, of whom Saddam Hussein was merely the latest and the most brutal. The United States came in and we smashed that system, and of course it's a good thing that we did. But it now means that the other groups in Iraq, the Kurds in the north, who none of whom want to be Iraqi, and the Shiites in the south, who are a majority but have always been repressed, now want to have their way. The Kurds want to retain the de facto independent state they've had for 13 years, and the Shiites believe it's their turn to run the whole country. And the United States is not facing that reality.
But is there not another reality that the Iraqis may want to avoid civil war? Do they not see that as an advantage? And is there not a benefit to all three groups in hanging together?
Well, yes, all three groups definitely want to avoid a civil war. But it is the exercise in trying to force a creation of an Iraqi identity and a common Iraqi state where none exists that's likely to create the civil war. The Americans did this when they took Kurdish troops and used them against the Arabs in Fallujah, leading the Arabs to say, well, when we get our turn, we're going to go there and cut your throats.
That must have made the Shiites and maybe the Kurds a bit uneasy to see a Sunni general back in Fallujah.
It certainly does. There's a great deal of anxiety about all this. The Kurds are very anxious about what Sistani says. There's a provision of the interim constitution that protects their rights. It says that the permanent constitution can only be approved if it's approved by Kurds, Sunnis, and Shiites. Sistani, the Shiite leader, says, I don't agree with that. If we're the majority, and we should be able to impose our will.
But surely you're not suggesting that President Bush come on television tonight and say, forget about a unified Iraq, we're going to have three states here.
Well, I would do something like that. I would have him come forward and say that mistakes have been made and that the United States has been much too ambitious with its idea of nation building, of creating a democratic Iraq that would transform the Middle East, and that now he's going to focus on a more pragmatic agenda, part of which is to avoid a civil war. And the way you do that is to have a loose federation and to allow each group the system that they want. It's not just that there's a huge ethnic divide between Kurds and Arabs. It is that the Kurds and some of the Arabs, the Shiites, for example, have very different visions of what Iraq should be. The Kurds want to continue the Western-style pluralistic or democratic system they've had. The Shiites seem to want an Islamic state. Polling data shows radically different views on the role of women between these two parts of Iraq. Radically different views between Arabs and Kurds about the Americans. 96% of the Kurds see the Americans as liberators. 7% of the Arabs do. It's very hard to build a common state, not only where you have the ethnic and religious differences, but also where you have such a different ideological vision of what the state should be.
Tom, that point is interesting.
Yes, John Howard.
One of the things we're advised by the White House that the president is going to say tonight is that our coalition and the Iraqi people have the same enemies, terrorists, illegal militia, Saddam, loyalists.
Mm-hmm.
It is certainly not evident from what's happening on the ground that something called the Iraqi people thinks it has common enemies with the United States, but that is that assertion by the president is certainly going to be put to the test.
Well, I wonder, President Bush, despite the attestations that he's always staunch and never changes policy, in fact, policy has changed. Do you see the leeway in terms of strategic thinking or political options, John Harwood, for the president to hear a message like Peter Galbraith's and say, maybe we should have an extremely loose federation here that almost amounts to independent territories, or is that just not in the cards at all?
Well, I think, Tom, the president has changed enough, that is, by placing a lot of the responsibility in the hands of Lakhdar Brahimi, so that there is room for a variety of outcomes politically. But the president, you know, his political options aren't all that many in domestic terms. He cannot cut and run. He has to stay the course, as he defines it. But, of course, he's modified by putting more troops on the ground and by getting the U.N. involved.
Let's get a call in. Sarah's calling from Waltham, Massachusetts. Hi, Sarah. You're on the air.
Oh, hello. Thank you.
Sure.
First, after complimenting you on the way you handle this show, I love it, I have what I guess is a comment. Isn't it wonderful how our president, who has failed to win the hearts and minds of people halfway around the globe and failed to get us to know how to do it for them and rammed a war down our throats, has now discovered that he had better work a little bit on winning the hearts and minds of his own people that he is supposed to be governing.
Well, that's exactly what his agenda is tonight.
Yes, exactly. Well, good luck.
It sounds like you're skeptical. Sarah, our time before the break is short, and we don't have John Harwood much longer. John, you've written that there's a question about people thought this would be a very close election. You're saying now there's a notion abroad or out there that it may be a runaway election, one way or another, and that the question is whether it will follow the pattern of Jimmy Carter or Richard Nixon. That is, Carter, who faced the sort of looking helpless over the hostage situation in Iran, losing big, or Nixon turning around saying, yes, we're in trouble, but my opponent, George McGovern, cannot handle it, and winning big himself. Is that something that you're looking at emerging here?
I think it's quite possible, Tom. One of the ongoing debates among political strategists in this election is just how big is the swing vote. In past election, it's been maybe a quarter of the electorate. The country's very polarized politically now. Strategists for the president's campaign say that the amount of swing vote is fewer than 10%. But whether it's 10% or 25%, there are enough voters in play that when they make a bottom line judgment in October, right around or just after the debates between John Kerry and George W. Bush, I think the odds are, and certainly the recent history of terribly close elections, unlike 2000, suggests that voters in the middle are going to make a decision more or less in concert with one another and decide, do we want more of this or not? President Bush could still win decisively. He could also lose decisively.
Six speeches, we're told. Is that a serious number? Is he really going to be on air every week from now until June 30th talking about Iraq?
He's definitely going to be out there talking about Iraq. How much airtime he gets as those weeks pass, we'll see. But there's no doubt that June 30th is one of the most important landmarks in the 2004 election campaign for the president. He cannot afford to lose the American people, to lose connection with this argument about why we need to stay there and see through the transition to a free Iraq.
John Harwood, I know we have to let you go. Thank you so much for being with us tonight.
My pleasure.
John Harwood, political editor at the Wall Street Journal. Ambassador Peter Galbraith, I hope you'll stay with us. Listeners, you can join us as well. The president speaks in just 20 minutes now. Do you see the Middle East's prototype democracy emerging, however fitfully, in Iraq? We're at 1-800-423-8255. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Tonight, President Bush speaks on the future of Iraq, the first of six planned speeches, we're told, aimed at bolstering sharply lagging support for White House policy in Baghdad. It's a tall order, but the president is stepping up tonight at the Army War College in Pennsylvania. In recent days, he has taken a lot of flack, including flack from very senior Republicans. Late last week, Republican Senator from Indiana and Chairman of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, Richard Lugar, delivered the commencement address at the Fletcher School of Law and Diplomacy at Tufts University. He said the U.S. must assign its economic and diplomatic capabilities the same strategic priority as its military capabilities, saying there are no shortcuts to victory. He was faulting President Bush in this speech. Let's listen to just a little bit of Dick Lugar.
Unless the United States commits itself to a sustained program of repairing and building alliances, expanding trade, pursuing resolutions to regional conflicts, supporting democracy and development worldwide, and controlling weapons of mass destruction, we are likely to experience acts of catastrophic terrorism that will undermine our economies, damage our societies, and kill hundreds of thousands, if not millions, of people. The United States, as a nation, simply has not made this commitment.
Republican Senator from Indiana, Richard Lugar, chairman of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, speaking late last week at Tufts University. We're talking tonight about the challenges faced by the president and Iraq as he steps up to the podium this evening. You can join our conversation tonight. How can the president answer his critics, Republican and Democrat, who say his administration has bungled Iraq? What structure can the U.S. and U.N. give Iraq in the next 5 weeks that will give Iraq a chance to make it on its own? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I've been joined tonight from Washington by Ambassador Peter Galbraith, former U.S. Ambassador to Croatia, Senior Diplomatic Fellow at the Center for Arms Control and Nonproliferation. We're joined now also from Washington by Lawrence Korb, former Assistant Secretary of Defense in the Reagan administration and a Senior Fellow at the Center for American Progress, Senior Advisor at the Center for Defense Information. Good evening and welcome, Lawrence Korb.
Nice to be with you, Tom.
It's great to have you. We heard earlier a clip from General Zinni, very critical of the civilian leadership of the Pentagon. What kind of ear are you keeping to the military brass, the active duty military brass these days, Lawrence Korb? Are they still on board with President Bush and his Secretary of Defense, Donald Rumsfeld?
Well, the Army is not. The Army felt, and the Marine Corps, I should say, the ground forces, felt that when you go into war, you always hope for the best, but you plan for the worst. They felt that Rumsfeld just reversed that and ignored people like General Zinni and General Shinseki, who General Zinni quotes, who told them that you were going to need several hundred thousand people after you got rid of the Saddam's regime in order to provide security in the country. We didn't do that. Consequently, we've never really caught up and got that situation under control. We've allowed the insurgency to develop. We've allowed the people to come in from other countries. And now, a year after Saddam fell, we're probably in worse situation than we were a year ago.
Peter Galbraith, General Zinni's critique aside, and it's a pretty tough one, Donald Rumsfeld has said, though less of late, war is chaotic, and it's simply not possible to have a picture-perfect outcome after an invasion and the toppling of a tyrant like Saddam Hussein. How far does that go to cover what we've seen in the last year in Iraq?
Not very far. Of course, war is not picture-perfect. But we entered Baghdad, a city that was largely undamaged because of the precision of the bombing. And in the first 2 months of the occupation, every significant public institution in the city was burned and looted. And not all of it was preventable, but it was all predictable, and some of it was preventable. Had we secured 50 buildings, I think we would have faced a very different psychological environment. And there was a list that was prepared by the State Department, sent over to Doug Feith, one of the top civilian leaders of the Pentagon, and it never came out of his office.
A list of sites to be protected.
Sites to be protected. And it wasn't hard. I went into buildings as they were being looted in those early days of April 2003, and these looters were not at all threatening. In fact, when I went through the Foreign Ministry, which was a treasure trove of documents that we ought to have seized and exploited, looters were there giving me floppy disks and other information.
I have to say they look pretty threatening in some of the TV footage with the Kalashnikovs and pickup trucks and, you know, ripping buildings apart.
Well, in some places, but the people who looted the National Library or the Foreign Ministry or some of the other critical sites were unarmed, ordinary people. And you know, the scenes were really quite chaotic. I saw people. Everybody felt that this was an opportunity. You had people from the poor suburbs. They were taking stuff they didn't even know what to do.
But you're saying it didn't have to be this way with some force applied there, with some troops.
Or simply security.
Stabilizing
simply
security.
Going to these buildings and securing them. The trouble with the looting is that it profoundly demoralized the Iraqi professionals with whom we want to work because every professional is linked to some institution.
And we're still paying for that all these months, a year on now. Alon is calling from Madison, Wisconsin. Hi, Alon. You're on the air.
Hi. Good to be on the air.
Wonderful to have you.
I just had a quick comment and a question.
Yeah.
I voted for George Bush, and I supported his entry into Iraq. But now, 3.5 years later, what I think is going on is an intellectual dishonesty, maybe ineptitude. He's always been criticized for not being an intellectual heavyweight, but I think that you need to be able to remain flexible and change with circumstances, and he has done it in a political way, not in a real way.
But, Alon, don't you expect the president to come on tonight and say, look, we've got to stick with this. We can't let Iraq sink into chaos and disarray, though there's plenty of that right now, acknowledged. But don't you think he can still come up with a message that some significant portion of Americans are going to respond to? We can't just walk away from this. We've got to work with the UN. We've got to try and build a new government here.
I think that's the answer to that is duh. I mean, that's an obvious statement, and that's what he's very good at right now. He's mm-hmm. making obvious statements. But you had a gentleman earlier on your show
yep.
that said, we are trying to keep together a country that shouldn't actually be a country. It never had been before, shouldn't in the future. This would not be a great change in our role in Iraq to establish three democracies in the place of one terrible military dictatorship.
Of course, one wonders if the oil can be divided up three ways, and each of them would depend on that. But, Alon, we appreciate your call. Thanks very much for joining us. Lawrence Korb, what about this issue? Peter Galbraith is very skeptical about Iraq's capacity to go on as Iraq. He says that the problem with Iraq, the fundamental problem, is an absence of Iraqis, i.e. this isn't a real country, and suggests a very loose federation or confederation. What do you see? Let's say that President Bush was just as flexible as he could be and willing to work with the United Nations. What's the form that he, the country, the world should be looking to throw over this?
Well, the looser the better, at least to begin with, because those three groups have got to learn to trust each other, particularly the Kurds. As Ambassador Galbraith has said on many occasions, lots of other people have, the Shiites want to govern. The Sunnis don't trust the Shiites, and the Kurds basically want to continue the independence they've had over the last decade. And you may remember that one of our plans, interim constitutions, failed because the Kurds wanted to have a veto power. Three of the 18 provinces vetoed something. That wouldn't go through, and the Ayatollah
right.
Sistani didn't like that. And that's the challenge that you have. And, you know, the clock is ticking. This June 30th deadline was set more for our elections than elections over there.
Because George Bush wanted to present what image?
He wanted to present an image that basically there was an Iraqi government in place, and this would show that he's making progress toward his goal, you know, of a free, democratic Iraq.
Ambassador Galbraith, President Bush would also like to be able to talk about American soldiers coming home at some point, I presume, unless he's going to continue to say we just have to stay there as long as necessary. Do you see an end point to the need for American troops in the 100,000-plus level in Iraq?
Not with the present strategy. As long as the idea is to make Iraq a model democracy for the Middle East, we're going to be there for a very long time. In fact, we'll need more troops because our efforts are counterproductive. But if we accept the idea that this is a place with very disparate regions, with very different views, then there's a way out. Specifically, rather than trying to eliminate the institutions of self-government in Kurdistan or bring in the central government, leave it alone. There are fewer than 300 coalition troops there, and there's no need to change that. In the south, the Shiites asked for and got in the interim constitution the right to form their own region. Let them do that. And if in elections in that region produce a victory for the religious parties, which I think they will, and they want to have an Islamic state, let them have it, but only in the south. And then the center, which is the most troubled area, at least until the most recent Shiite uprising.
The Sunni middle of the country.
The Sunni triangle.
Mm-hmm.
The problem there is that these are the people that have always run the country. They're the ones who benefited from Saddam's regime and from the regimes before. Understandably, they're having a hard time adjusting to their loss of power and status. They feel very insecure. If they have their own region, and then I think there's a higher degree of security that they will feel. We may get responsible leaders who are prepared to provide order, and we may be able to pull out of there. So an exit strategy requires turning things over to the different peoples of Iraq, but not to a mythical Iraqi people. and Iraqi central government institutions, which just don't have traction.
David's calling from Braintree, Massachusetts. Hi, David. You're on the air.
Hi.
Hi.
I have got a number of surveys of students and faculty at several universities. I'm at MIT myself, on the impression that President Bush has left in his speeches about Iraq. And one of the most fascinating summary conclusions of these surveys has been that the most descriptive statement that could be made of his sense of Iraq is that I need to convince the world of the legitimacy and righteousness of my policy in America.
That's been pretty clearly consistent, yeah.
And the least descriptive would be, I really care about the Iraqi people and understand the disillusionment and the pain and the confusion that they've been through.
You're saying that one just doesn't seem to apply. Let us pick those up, David. Thanks very much for your call. Lawrence Korb, is there a way for the president to span this perceived gap tonight to show both a strong profile that he needs politically at home, but also flexibility, sensitivity, signal to Iraq, even the degree of flexibility that Ambassador Galbraith is suggesting, where you'd have something that wasn't even a unitary state in Iraq?
Well, I think he can do it in two ways. One, he has to admit that we've made mistakes, that we're not perfect. And I'd like to also see him hold some people accountable. You know, that might be asking too much, but I think both of those would go a long way toward both the people here in the United States and the people in Iraq, and then say, I don't have all the answers. We're going to, you know, get the rest of the world to help us, and you people will decide, you know, exactly what state that you want and how you want it to work.
Well, a tall order. Peter Galbraith, we've just got you for a minute more. If you could whisper in the president's ear tonight a kind of fundamental philosophical attitude that he ought to take into this next month and 6 months or less now before the election, what would it be? What would your advice be?
First, I think he has to admit that we've made huge mistakes. Because if he doesn't admit that, then he's going to continue on a failed course of action. Second, I think he and his team need to have a greater understanding of Iraq. When we went into the Balkans in the Clinton administration, we did a huge amount of preparation, and we made sure we understood the terrain, and as a result, there, in 9 years of involvement, there's not been a single American casualty in combat. They haven't done any of that. It's late in the day to do it, but they really need to have a better understanding of the terrain in which they're operating.
Well, perhaps we're learning. Perhaps the UN can bring some to bear. We'll see what the president has to say in just a few minutes now. Ambassador Peter Galbraith, thank you very much for being with us tonight.
Well, it's very good to be with you.
Ambassador Peter Galbraith, former U.S. Ambassador to Croatia, now Senior Diplomatic Fellow at the Center for Arms Control and Nonproliferation. And Lawrence Korb, we're all going to settle back and listen to the president now. I hope you'll join us again on the other side of his speech in Pennsylvania.
I sure will.
Okay, looking forward to that. Listeners, you can continue this conversation online at onpointradio.org. Click on forums. We will be back in just a moment with the president at the Army War College in Carlisle Barracks, Pennsylvania, for his speech. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.